The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency. Serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now, one more time, we return to the January 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We are going to read, as we always do on the last reading of the month, the series of decade articles, and we're starting a brand new one this month. We covered the 60s last year and the 50s the year before that. And this year, would you like to take a guess which decade we're going to cover? Since 2018, author Philip Girard has delved into pivotal decades of the 20th century. In the coming year, his stories about the 1970s will explore the Vietnam War, racial conflict, and new leadership roles for women in North Carolina. This month, a preview of the decade shaped by radical change. A new series, The Decade of Disruption, 1970s, written by Philip Girard. Across the globe from Vietnam, effects of the war reverberate through North Carolina, where social and political perspectives are shifting quickly and dramatically. There are a number of photo excerpts here on the page. One is a black and white photo of, I am tempted to say, thousands of people lined up on a street in a march, shoulder to shoulder. There's a policeman, I think, walking along the edge of the crowd. It looks like they're walking on one side of the street in one direction, but it's a little unclear because it kind of weaves around in an S shape here. The next one is of a pier on the North Carolina shore with cloudy, storm-like clouds in the distance and some sunbathers. Presumably some sun is left there in the foreground. And then there's a woman speaking at a microphone with a whole bunch of stuff in her hands, and there's some buttons, peace now, with the peace sign in the hand, peace now with a dove, and free the Wilmington 10 now, showing an African-American man behind bars. And beside the picture of the woman, it says, in the 1970s, North Carolina was shaped by local initiatives. 1974 legislation preserved the beauty of Kill Devil Hills, which was, I guess, the picture to the left, as well as national events. After the Kent State shooting, students marched on the state capitol. That was the black and white photo. And Kathy Sterling, North Carolina State's first female student body president, called for a university peace retreat. And now, the article. For 30 years, North Carolina has moved inexorably toward a future connected by better roads and electrical grids, a unified system of colleges and universities, a stronger economy, and the advancement of civil rights. The wartime 1940s propelled the state into manufacturing overdrive of textiles and ships, even as a literal army of tens of thousands of newcomers swelled its military camps and bases, the Cape Fear River shipyard, and the Fontana Dam site. The 1950s captured the ebullient post-war optimism of a state on the move, new highways full of shiny cars driven by GI Bill-educated veterans speeding their families toward leisure destinations, while a coalition of private and public partners created a research oasis in the Piedmont and civil rights activists pressed forward with desegregation. In the 1960s, the state was christened the Dixie Dynamo for its creative energy across a wide range of endeavors, from entrepreneurial high-tech business to environmental preservation to a burgeoning art and literature scene. When four young black college students took a seat at a whites-only lunch counter in Greensboro, they inspired a nonviolent reckoning on civil rights that swept the nation and made history. Now the 1970s takes on a different character as a decade of disruption. Some disruptions change the community all at once and forever for the good. Native tribes have long battled for equality, a political voice, and economic prosperity. In 1971, North Carolina establishes the State Commission of Indian Affairs and recognizes the Kohari and Waccamaw Siouan tribes. The first American Indian-owned bank in the U.S. is established at Pembroke by members of the Lumbee tribe. And in 1973, the Lumbee of Robeson County achieve a major political breakthrough. Henry Ward Oxendine wins election to the General Assembly, the first Native American in history to do so. The role of women in leadership also changes dramatically. In 1974, Susie Sharp becomes the first female Chief Justice in North Carolina and the first popularly elected female Chief Justice in the United States. The following year, Beth Finch is elected mayor of Fayetteville. And in 1977, Isabel Cannon is elected mayor of Raleigh. Both are the first female mayors to serve their cities. Meanwhile, the state gains a sudden influx of new citizens from cultures halfway around the world. As the Vietnam War reaches its disastrous conclusion in 1975, some 125,000 Vietnamese refugees flee to America, about 2,400 of them settling in North Carolina by decade's end. In the 1980s, another wave emigrates. The refugees include Laotians and Hmong tribespeople who were fierce U.S. allies in the war. Some of the disruption leads in the creative direction. The planners of the new North Carolina Zoological Park in Asheboro throw out the old model of keeping wild animals in captivity and replace it with a whole new paradigm, which they call alive. Previously, zoo animals were kept in enclosures where they could be viewed for entertainment and educational purposes. The new model recreates their native habitats. The zoo, occupying 1,005 acres, including Purgatory Mountain, opens in 1979 and eventually becomes an adventure land of rainforest and African savanna, Sonoran desert, and North American wilderness. Some disruptions tear the fabric of community and take decades to mend. Court-ordered desegregation of Wilmington's high schools for the 1969-70 academic year brings always fraught race relations to a head. Rather than desegregate all schools, the school board closes the all-black Williston Senior High School, forcing its students to be bused to two formerly all-white schools. In January 1971, citing mistreatment by administrators and discrimination by teachers and white students, black students declare a citywide boycott. Led by Benjamin Chavis, an activist from Oxford, they make their headquarters in the Gregory Congregational Church and draw up a list of grievances and demands. Meanwhile, a vigilante group calling itself Rights of White People, ROWP, openly patrols the downtown in armed bands. Several white businesses go up in flames, including Mike's, a neighborhood grocery store near the church. The police shoot and kill a black student leader. Next day, a white vigilante is killed in an act of attacking the church. Through the long ordeal, a few reasonable people exercise remarkable bravery in trying to heal the racial divide. But the continued violence at the last brings in the National Guard. 10 people, Chavis, 8 other black men, and a white female social worker are arrested, tried, and sentenced to a long prison terms. Christened the Wilmington 10, they are later proven to be innocent scapegoats. In 1980, the federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals overturns their convictions. One event rends the fabric of a city in neighboring South Carolina. On the morning of September 11, 1974, Eastern Airlines Flight 212 is approaching Charlotte's Douglas Municipal Airport in heavy ground fog. Members of the flight crew are distracted by conversations, quote, on several non-operational subjects and fail to heed the altitude alarm. The Douglas DC-9 crashes into a muddy cornfield 3 miles short of the runway, killing 72 people, 38 of them from Charleston. The victims include a newly promoted admiral, a former spokesman for the North Carolina governor, and the father and two brothers of a boy named Stephen Colbert, who will go on to TV fame. Miraculously, 11 people initially survived the second worst air disaster in North Carolina history. From the days of Reconstruction following the Civil War, North Carolina has been a Democratic stronghold, which in former days was the party of white supremacy. Now the Democratic Party has embraced civil rights, and in a landslide vote, Republican Richard Nixon has won the White House, executing a Southern strategy of appealing to white, formerly Democratic voters with coded racial messages. In 1972, for the first time in the 20th century, North Carolinians elect a Republican governor, James E. Holzhauser, Jr. But voters also elect a rising Democratic star, James B. Hunt, Jr., as lieutenant governor, and return a Democratic-controlled legislature. As presiding officer of the state Senate, Hunt arguably wields as much power as the governor, championing the passage of popular legislation, such as an act increasing pay for teachers. In 1976, Hunt wins election to governor with 52% of the vote. At the beginning of his term, the General Assembly, augmented by a popular mandate, passes legislation that allows the governor two consecutive terms in office. Hunt becomes the first governor to succeed himself. Then, after a four-year interim, he wins two more consecutive terms for a total of 16 years in the governor's mansion. While Holzhauser is still governor, he and Hunt support a bipartisan bill called the Coastal Area Management Act, CEMA, an effort to steward the shorelines of North Carolina's 20 coastal counties in concert with local governments. The goal is preserving and managing the natural ecological conditions of the estuarine system, the barrier dune system, and the beaches, so as to be safe in guarding and perpetuating their natural productivity and their biological, economic, and aesthetic values. In a decade blessedly free of landfall by major hurricanes, as tourism stream across the Bonner Bridge into the Outer Banks, now a hot vacation spot, and developers cite major projects in the villages between the National Seashore Zones, CAMA comes just in time. Years in the making, but timely in its appearance, the revolutionary disruption of unbridled coastal development, like so many others, comes in two ways: gradually and then suddenly. Coming next month, North Carolina State's Peace Retreat teaches students about the Vietnam War. 2 weeks ago, we read an article about HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. This is a follow-on to that article, butted right up against it. Didn't get a chance to read it at that time. For 155 years, the state's historically black colleges and universities have produced activists, scientists, educators, and artists. From the Greensboro Four at NCA&T State University, who advanced the civil rights movement, to North Carolina Central University alumnus Andre Leon Talley, a former Vogue editor, some of the nation's brightest leaders have been molded in North Carolina. Down here, there's this little blurb about Winston-Salem State University, the first black institution in the country to grant degrees in elementary education. Winston-Salem State University later in 1967 became the first HBCU to win an NCAA basketball championship with the help of Earl the Pearl Monroe. The school's Diggs Gallery is one of the most prominent galleries dedicated to African and American art in the region. Barber Scotia College in Concord, 1867, which is when it was formed. Barber Scotia College was established as a Presbyterian school to educate young black women in teaching and social work. Alumna Mary McLeod Bethune served as an educator, civil rights advocate, and advisor to President Franklin D. Roosevelt. North Carolina Central University in Durham, founded in 1910. Chartered in 1909, the North Carolina Central University became the first state-supported liberal arts college for black students in the nation. Eagles learned to soar with programs in the sciences, arts, and business, and law. Just ask notable alumna Tressie McMillan Cotton, a writer and sociologist, also a professor and 2020 MacArthur Fellow. I don't know why there's a discrepancy between the dates 1909 and 1910, which they list right under the heading here. But I guess that's not terribly important. There's a picture here of James Edward Shepherd, born in 1875, founder and president, North Carolina College at Durham. It says a statue of North Carolina Central University founder James Shepherd greets visitors to the Durham campus. And in Greensboro, in a photo below, students at the Woman's Only Bennett College took a break from classes in the 1920s. And every one of them has a hat on, and all but two of them are different. Two of the hats are the same. They might be the sisters or something like that. And the women are all pretty formally dressed, and they seem to have ties on, most of them, over white blouses. Bennett College in Greensboro, 1873. Bennett Bells took part in the Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins of 1960, a movement that inspired social change here and beyond. Bennett is one of two women's only HBCUs in the United States. And in 1955, the school's president, Dr. Wilma B. Player, became the first black woman in the nation to serve as a college president. North Carolina Agriculture and Technical State University, Greensboro, 1891. Now the nation's largest HBCU, North Carolina A&T State, was established to teach agricultural and mechanical arts. Today, the home of Aggie Pride and the greatest homecoming on earth is nationally recognized for its STEM programs, which produced the late NASA astronaut Ronald McNair, a mission specialist in the Space Shuttle Challenger. Photo at the top says the sun rises over the Student Center at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro, and below, a student drummer warms up A&T's greatest homecoming on earth. And now a bunch more before we finish. Johnson C. Smith University, Charlotte, 1897. Since the school was founded by two Presbyterian ministers in 1867, the Golden Bulls have fostered strong relationships with other North Carolina HBCUs, including a past partnership with then all-woman Barber Scotia College, and a friendly rivalry with Livingstone College, which began with the first black intercollegiate football game in 1892. Fayetteville State University in Fayetteville, 1867, one of the first state-supported teacher training schools in the South for black students. Fayetteville State University now maintains top national rankings for nursing, criminal justice, and MBA programs. St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, 1867. St. Augustine's was founded by the Episcopal Church, an affiliation that the university maintains to this day. The school educated Anna J. Cooper, the mother of black feminism, launched the first HBCU on-campus radio and TV stations, and recently started the first HBCU cycling team. Livingstone College is in Salisbury since 1879. The home of the Blue Bears was established by the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church as a school for newly freed enslaved people. The first president of the college, Dr. Joseph Charles Price, believed in the education in the hands, the head, and the heart, evidenced by Livingstone's focus on liberal arts education and STEAM programs. Kittrell College in Kittrell, 1886 to 1975. Kittrell College was founded by the African Methodist Episcopal Church as a vocational school to train teachers and tradesmen. The college shut its doors in 1975, but a North Carolina educator has plans to revive it. And finally, Elizabeth City State University. Elizabeth City in 1891. From a modest 23 students when it began to graduating more than 20,000 students over the course of nearly 130 years, Elizabeth City State University has evolved from a school for teachers to one that offered more than 30 undergraduate and graduate degree programs, including aviation. Among ECSU's notable alumni, 60s and 70s era Dallas Cowboys defensive tackle Jethro Pugh. And now we are going to pick up in an article we had to abandon in the first week, I think it was. We were reading an article called Hidden Treasures from North Carolina University Libraries. And I have a note that we stopped on this page. It doesn't look like the right page to me. Did I lose my... Oh, here we are. Yes. Winston-Salem University, we had talked about the Philomathesian Society banner, but we didn't talk about Maya Angelou papers. Prolific author and civil rights activist Maya Angelou was named Wake Forest's first Z. Smith Reynolds Professor of American Studies in 1982, a position she held until her death in 2014. The university has many of her film and theater materials, including the manuscript for her poem, And Still I Rise, which she was adapting for the stage. And here it is. It looks like it's written in pencil. And she's got some words crossed out and corrected on it. And Overleaf, Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte. A picture of a leather-seated wooden chair. The Taft Chair. The story goes that President William Howard Taft sat in this plain wooden chair, specially procured for his outsized stature, in 1909 while delivering a speech at Johnson C. Smith University, then known as Biddle University. Except Taft never really sat in the chair at all. Brandon Lunsford, university archivist and digital manager, says that the truth is widely accepted. It's a cool little artifact and just a fun story, he explains. The whereabouts of the actual Taft chair remain a mystery. It does show him sitting in a chair, but you can clearly see it's not the same chair. And now... Appalachian State University. Most of these two pages is taken up by a picture of an old record player, and it says Doc Watson, shown as a lanky 17-year-old, is one of 130 musicians recorded by folk song collector W. Amos Abrams, who donated his materials to App State's library in 1974. There's a small picture of Doc way down on the right-hand side with his guitar. This looks like a plastic record player with a plastic arm on it and a disc that says Silvertone Recorded Disc. And I think it's the original because it, there's a place that says title, date, and number, and it's handwritten inside. I can't read the writing, but this must have been an original recording. Doc Watson recording. The static is thick, but the voice of an 18-year-old Doc Watson comes through clear and strong. She was called from this earth, the jewel for heaven. The cover of Roy Acuff's song, The Precious Jewel, preserved on a 10-inch silver-tone disc, is the first recording Watson ever made. W. Amos Abrams, an English professor and folk song scholar at what was then Appalachian State Teachers College, captured the performance at the Boone Fiddlers Convention on July 4th, 1941, as part of a 10-year project to document traditional music in the Appalachian region. Professors and folk music lovers like Abrams were among the first to study local residents as a sophisticated people, says Trevor McKenzie, university library specialist. Their work helped lay the foundation for the university's master's program in Appalachian Studies. This record is a window into Watson's mind as a musician, McKenzie says. That's why it's special, because it shows him at the start. Shaw University in Raleigh. Medical school artifacts. Items in Shaw University's library tell the story of the school's short yet strong medical history. The Leonard Medical School notebook above of Dr. C.W. Furlong, a 1914 graduate, a 1909 commencement program, and a picture of the 1889 graduating class. Shaw's medical school became the first in the U.S. to offer a four-year curriculum in 1882. The program lasted only 36 years, but it graduated nearly 400 physicians during that time, helping Raleigh develop a strong black middle class. So we see a couple of really old books at the top. One says, Quis Compens Pharmacy. And the other one, you can't read the title. It's stamped on it. And down the bottom, we see Leonard, Pharmacy and Medicine. And in the middle is a circle with a skull in it and some ivy coming out of either side of the skull. And it says 09 beside it. And there's some old pharmacy bottles there. Virginia Louise Glenn Military Collection. A pendant, shown above, and other keepsakes preserve the memory of Virginia Glenn, a 1939 Shaw graduate who helped sort mail for millions of service members as part of the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only all-black, all-female unit overseas during World War II. And here's an old black-and-white photo, or sepia-toned photo, I guess I should say, of a bunch of men, so I don't really understand the reference to the all-female overseas unit, and then we have the photo. I guess maybe the photo goes with the Shaw University artifacts. Overleaf Duke University, Durham, The Birds of America. Once a month, Duke librarians turn the massive, centuries-old pages of John James Audubon's The Birds of America, showcased in the Mary Duke Biddle Room. The university's copy of the book is one of about 120 original four-volume sets that exist today. Two volumes are on display showing off watercolor illustrations of North American birds like ivory-billed woodpeckers and snowy owls shown here. In total, the volumes printed between 1827 and 1838 contain 435 birds, some of which are now extinct. For Duke, to have a copy of this is to allow us to study things that no longer exist, says Naomi Nelson, Associate University Librarian and Director of the Rubenstein Library. And fuel-efficient car. The average car gets about 20 to 40 miles per gallon. Maxwell, the sleek 50-pound car that Duke Electric Vehicles students built in 2017, gets a whopping 14,573. On July 21st, 2018, Maxwell, named after Scottish physicist James Maxwell, broke the Guinness World Record for fuel efficiency, which had stood for 13 years. When you put 15 kids in a room together, they can do some things that are pretty incredible, says Patrick Grady, former DEV president. Well, that's it. We ran out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll listen next time when we crack the cover on the February issue. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. You can reach them at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions, comments? 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.